Hello, folks, and welcome to Write the Docs episode. Wow, what are we up to now? Jeez, it's like 28 or something, isn't it, guys? I can't believe how many we've got. Episode 16. Yeah, no, it's not quite that. No, it's we're getting up there in episodes now. We've been doing this for nearly 2 or 3 years now, which is kind of crazy to think that so many people have joined us on the show to date. Anyhow, I digress, which is what I normally do at 5:30 in the morning. I'm Jared Morgan. I'm a technical writer at a company here in Brisbane called Squiz, and it's turning out to be quite a fun gig at the moment. I'm never short of work, so that's very good. It's good problem to have if you're a technical writer. But it's not just me on the show today. I've joined with a myriad of other people on the show, including our regulars. So let's introduce them and see how they're going this time round. We'll start with Tom Johnson in the US. Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm going very well. Yeah. You notice, Jared, there's kind of an idiom that you often say that is kind of fun when you say how are you going. It's kind of an Australia thing, I think, right?
It is very much. How are you going? Yeah. We also drop a whole lot of words just for you as well.
Do people in Australia often respond like "I'm going well," or do they not say that?
Often it's all right, mate, or whatever, you know. It's a bit well, like "Have you eaten?" in some countries, you know how they say that. Yeah.
It's going great here. We have a 3-day weekend, so looking forward to doing my taxes and other fun stuff. So.
Oh, yep. Right. That sounds fun. How about you, Chris? Hello there, Chris, over in Berlin at the moment.
Yeah, although currently in Manchester in the UK. We're visiting for fun, basically. Although I'm actually meeting the person who organizes the Manchester meetup, Write the Docs meetup on Tuesday. So a little bit of a connection there.
Awesome.
And I work for a few different people, but I'm actually about to embark on a short period of fun employment, semi-intentionally. So watch this space, because there'll be lots of things emerging.
Oh, very good. Well, we'll have to follow you on the Twitters. Where can we find you on Twitter, by the way, for those people who haven't yet?
Chris Chinch.
Chris Chinch. Very good. All right, we'll have to check that out. Thanks, Chris. So we are joined today by two folks, both in the US. So I'd like to introduce them to you. Let's start first with Cynthia Ng. How are you, Cynthia?
I'm good, thank you. But a correction is I'm in Canada, not in the US.
Canada, oh yes. I can't make that mistake. Oh my goodness.
I wondered if you were going to let that pass.
Canadian with any, no self-respecting Canadian could ever let pass that they're in Canada, not in the US.
Oh, absolutely.
It's going well. The weather's actually been holding out despite being in the Pacific Northwest. I'm actually on Vancouver Island on the very west side of British Columbia. As we say, beautiful British Columbia. I'm currently a support engineer at GitLab, but I think what's a bit more relevant today for today's topic that I'm sure we'll get into is that I've worked myriad jobs, mostly because they were contracts, but I've worked at a whole bunch of academic institutions, both university and colleges. I've worked at mostly libraries, public library, but also nonprofits that served library members. But I've also worked in government and basically a lot of public institutions and that sort of thing. I do have my master's of library and information science, so I'm by trade, so to speak, a librarian. Many of us who are very avid documentarians, so that's why I'm here.
Yes, I follow some librarians on Twitter. I know that they are indeed very avid documentarians, so that's very true. Thanks for that. That was a great intro, Cynthia. Now, there's one other person joining us today, and her name is Amy Qualls. Hello, Amy.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us today, and then tell us a bit about yourself.
So I am a shiny, shiny new technical writer at GitLab. I have been here for 2 months, long enough to still be questioning, what have I done? Why have you made the mistake in hiring me? That sort of thing. I've been a technical writer for another startup before, and while I can't claim librarian status, I did work at a public library. The difference is surprisingly important to people who have MLSs and MLISs. And so I try not to cast myself as something that I was not, for fear of going down in verbal flames.
Also a great introduction. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's great. So there's definitely a library flavor in today's show, which is going to be good. The more librarians, the better. Righto, let's get stuck in to today's subject. And I've titled it a working title of Documentarians or It Didn't Happen, because what we're going to talk about today is when folks work in organizations that don't have a technical writer and have to set up an organization inside the business to start up technical writing from scratch, not necessarily part of their job, but they see a need and they do it. And we're lucky enough to be joined by Cynthia and Amy, who, you know, probably have a bit of insight into that. So, and this is going to be a very interesting topic. It's hard sometimes starting off from scratch. So I think by the end of this, we should have a few tips and tricks perhaps to get around those little hairy edge cases that we might find as we start up a technical writing department or even a loan writer technical writing department. So let's get stuck in. So as background, I think I might start with you, Cynthia, because you do have quite a varied lot of experience sort of working in various places and seeing this need arise. So how about you tell us what sort of positions you worked in leading up to the point at which you thought that setting up a technical writing gig in an organization was important?
Yeah, I mean, I do want to preface the fact that, like, in a lot of these organizations, it's never going to get to the point where there is a dedicated position for technical writing. So in all of these organizations, I mean, I've worked at a bunch of libraries, but again, also like nonprofits and government, you know, where you have a team of people. I usually ended up somewhere in technology. Right. And like your team is maybe your entire technology team might be like 4 or 5 people, if you even have an entire team for that. In many small organizations, you're the only technology or technologist who really does any kind of technology work. So I think what ends up happening is that every time I've gone to an organization, I just kind of often saw the need for it because, you know, as a new person, you'd often ask, okay, well, where can I find this information? And, you know, 90% of the time it was, oh, go ask that person over there. And, you know, especially coming, like it's interesting because this is actually at GitLab is the first actual tech company that I've ever worked at. So all of my experience prior to GitLab has been at kind of more public institutions and that sort of thing. And so it's like a lot of them have never heard of the bus factor kind of thing. Oh, yeah. Where I'm like, really, like this should be written somewhere, even if it's not easy to find, we should have this written somewhere. Instead of just in someone's brain. So this happened a lot. I worked a lot of contracts too, where it was like, you know, filling in for someone's sabbatical or parental leave or something. You're talking like usually a year, year and a half in some cases, most of my contracts. And and it's just like, as a new person, every time I went to a new institution, it really was just such a struggle to find information that I would need, because you literally have it either just in someone's brain or written down on someone's desk or written down in some, in maybe in emails, right? But who's ever going to find anything in emails, right? So so that's kind of usually in the position that I was in. And usually I ended up just kind of doing it off the side of my desk. But it became one of those roles that I saw was needful. And I would just try to convince my manager to not, like, to kind of give a minimal amount of support to get something started. You know, mostly with the rationale that I'm on a contract. If I leave in 6 months, a year, year and a half, 2 years, whatever it is, how is anyone going to know what I did or where everything is and how it's going to work? Because I'm not going to, like, sit somewhere for a week and tell someone else my entire life story sort of thing. And usually it was such that there was no replacement. The contract or the person I was replacing wouldn't be back until after, right? There was almost never overlap time with the person I was replacing. So yeah, so I just saw the need and just kind of rolled with it. We can get into other details later.
Yeah. That's a pretty good overview of pretty much the entire podcast right there. So that's quite a nice lead in. Amy, your story is a little bit the same, but not exactly the same, right?
Mine came from literally slamming my hands down on a table and saying, you know what would have helped me? So 9 years ago, I joined a startup that at the time around 70 people worldwide. I was employee number 73, and they flew me to Boston for my onboarding. And my onboarding consisted of, here's your laptop, please sign the sexual harassment policy, please sign your information so we can deposit your checks. You're good to go, right? You're ready to take support tickets, right?
Isn't that normally onboarding? I mean, that's been my experience. I thought that was just what it always
not
was.
Not by the time I was done.
That would be startup onboarding right there.
It really is. It really was. And so my first reaction was every time I hit something I didn't know or couldn't find, I had a Google Doc and I started writing it down. Mm-hmm. And fast forward to the end of my 3-week onboarding time in Boston, I walked into my mentor's office and slammed my hand down on Kenny's desk and said, you know what would have helped me? This. He looks at it, reads through it, and says, cool, we got another person starting in about 3 weeks. So can you have this ready for them? And that document, we started the policy unofficially because it's a startup. You're not going to have official policies. Mm. We made clear to every person who was being onboarded, your first job was to take this document, work through it, and anything that you found was a hole or a problem or slam your hand on desk, this is what someone should have told me, put it in the doc, and then give it to the next person. And some number of years later, I went back and checked, and there was my doc, except it had become a formal onboarding process. And that's actually how I got started doing documentation, literally slamming my hand down on a table.
Wow. That's quite the story right there. That's awesome. That's a bit of the background. So, and I think part of the next conversation, which I'll invite Tom and Chris to talk about is that you identified a need that documentation required, but sometimes that isn't as obvious as some of these sort of, you know, things. It just sort of comes about. So Chris and Tom, how about we delve into some of that that side of things as well? Chris, do you want to kick off a couple of questions around this area? Because it's sort of like one of the harder things sometimes to actually realize that you've got a problem to solve.
And I think from the perspective I've often worked in, which is mostly with developers onboarding, it's that you notice that people have to keep having a lot of conversations around the same thing over and over again. Or you're on remote teams and no one has that conversation and someone spends a lot of time wasting their time before they get to the point. So I guess there's some obvious places where you think, oh, this should be documented. But where do we think that the maybe the less obvious ones, or even some kind of things to look out for, rough ideas even of numbers of times you should do something before you think, okay, let's put this down somewhere. Two. Okay, all right.
Two or three is the numbers that Cynthia and Amy are holding up at the moment.
Yeah. And I must admit, I've struggled in engineering teams to make them often think this is worth it, but that's a whole other conversation. What have your experiences being in identifying that time, and I guess then getting someone to actually, well, I guess in your case, Amy, it was you just did it, but maybe more formally, hopefully getting someone to agree that it's a good idea as well.
It took a couple of years. I ended up working in the support team, and then they decided, you know, this is, given that the company is rapidly expanding, perhaps we should put someone on this, you know, half time. Let's not be overzealous here. Let's give someone half time to work on documentation and onboarding. And I ended up being in that position for about 5 years.
Okay. Right. And was this mostly internal stuff, I'm guessing, or not necessarily?
At first. After a while, the lone documentarian for the external docs figured out I knew more about some of their products than he did. And so what started out as, let me pass information over to you, gradually became, let me give you a write-up that you can polish. And then eventually it was, just publish this. It already meets your standards. And then I replaced him when he got a new job.
That's leveling up, 101.
I'm hoping we can clarify a point that I'm confused about. Are we talking about like an internal runbook for how the documentation team is set up and organized and published and all their processes? Or are we talking about actual internal documentation for other teams and their products? Or both here?
If that question was directed to me, it was a combination of internal run books, internal procedures, and then, wait, the reason nobody knew how to do this was because it was never in our public docs. So once I got the internal docs where I needed them to be, I started turning my focus to, let's take as much of this as possible and just, we should have made this public first anyway.
Can you maybe list out a few of the more prominent topics in this internal run book? I'm just kind of curious, what are some of these really important issues that you have in there?
A list of the systems that you need to gain access to when you're a new employee. Okay. Who controls them, where you need to file tickets to get them, and who to bother if that doesn't happen the way you expect. And then the goal with the onboarding documentation was to take someone from, here is your laptop, I pat you on the head and send you forth into the world to answer support tickets, to, here's where you can find information. Here is how you need to set up your laptop. Here's how our products work. Here's how you can gain access to them at a sysadmin level so that you can sign in, figure out what's going on, troubleshoot. I wrote up troubleshooting documentation for all of our products, and then go solve the problem.
Was there ever, I don't know why I think this, maybe just because sometimes people like things the way they are. Was there ever a time that someone said, don't do it, and gave you a justified reason?
There was a time where someone said, don't do it, but the reason was sort of unrelated. The pushback that I received on doing the documentation was not necessarily about what I was writing. It was the system that I was lodging the information in. They loved the idea, but could you not use this software? Why? Reasons. So.
It's interesting.
They opposed the idea of a wiki for reasons that honestly don't matter. It was 9 years ago. But once the company standardized on Atlassian products, everything moved over to Confluence. We had a solution that the entire company supported, and so we just moved the docs there.
Hey, Cynthia, I'm going to circle back to you about the reasons or the cues that you get to set up. But I just want to sort of ask, since we're talking about tools, in the various jobs that you've had, what sort of tools have been available to you to document stuff? Or is it just a text pad?
Oh, gosh.
Is that crying or laughing? I wasn't quite sure.
I'm not sure either. Let's go into this. It's one of those kind of almost desperation laughs, right? Like, depends on where I worked. I definitely had a range of what was available to me. And sometimes, you know, standardization is great. And sometimes standardization is really a struggle because of what that means. So I've, you know, done the gamut of you have Word docs because everyone uses SharePoint and that is the only thing you're allowed to use to, to, you know, like, and then it ranges from that all the way up to we have nothing and you get to decide what we're going to use, which, you know, it means that you don't have a lot of standardization. And it means that you need to set something up. But, you know, in those cases, it was interesting because then I think the best example was when we really didn't have anything set up. And so I convinced my manager, I'm like, hey, look, I asked a mailing list what tool to use. And I found one that is open source, free. Out of the box can do this thing that I wanted to and might take our sysadmin sysops guy a day. He did it over like a, you know, maybe 2 or 3 days, but total number of hours was less than a full day's work. So, and it just kind of, at least at a basic level, did pretty much everything we needed to do. So, we ended up going with Redmine. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of it or used it. This was years ago, but it was like one of those tools that was just out of the box, worked well. You wanted emails converted to issues, was a simple plugin, and that's all we really needed aside from what was already part of the product. And so it was actually, we ended up using it as an issue management tracker for not only projects internally, but also like for other staff members outside of the technology team to launch issues. So we just put up a form in our intranet and, you know, a lot of the dropdowns and stuff would pre-populate fields and which projects it would go to, all of that good stuff. And then, you know, there was a wiki for every project. So then we just ended up using the wiki for documentation. So it's, you know, I've had the huge range where you're kind of really stuck with whatever the institution gives you. And usually I ended up in Microsoft shops where, yes, it was basically Word and SharePoint or Word and some other document management system, which had the worst versioning. You want to create a merger version. Oh, you want to actually have a major version, you have to manually go through a workflow to say that it's a major version and then make sure there are no conflicts with other people trying to edit. Just like, really? Really? So I think sometimes it's just, you know, you use whatever you can. And, you know, and I've been in the middle, too, where like, kind of similar to Amy, one of the colleges I worked at, they were, you know, they had Confluence. At the time, we were on some free wiki of some sort that was, you know, just not that great. And I was like, hey, IT guys, can I just get a space in your Confluence and just let us move whatever content we want from our old wiki? And they were like, all right, give us a list of users that you want access to it and who's going to manage it. and that was it. So it, you know, it's definitely a range. I think, you know, when you work in institutions that are very established or that sort of thing, and you don't have like technical writers or a technical writing team and that sort of thing, I think you just kind of use whatever you can. And when you can go off on your own, sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad, because like I say, if it's very established or very institutionalized, you want other people on board and, you know, using the tools that they're used to using. So for me, it was more just about like, yeah, just get it written down in a place where other people can find it, and we'll go from there.
So what sort of cues do you think the cues that you saw in the businesses you're in were sort of the same as Amy's? Or do you think they were, depending on the job you're in, the cues that you needed a technical writer were different?
I think it's the same. I think a lot of it is just like the lack of information of where to do what and get where, that sort of thing. And certainly in a lot of places, in some places, some of the documentation was there, but just really hard to find. So just needed someone to kind of go in and help organize, you know, sometimes, like I say, you know, move it to a system where it's easier to find. Other times, you know, I think it's just, I mean, a lot of it is I would say almost selfish, right? Like you see a need for yourself, you know, much like Amy, you know, sometimes it's just when you're onboarding, you're like, okay, well, where do I find this information for myself? And then it's just a matter of like, hey, I think this would be useful for other people. So then you take notes and then you kind of just turn it into something that would make sense to other people. And definitely, but for the institution as well, because like I mentioned, I worked a lot of contracts. I'm like, well, if I leave, what happens to all that knowledge, right? And that knowledge needs to go somewhere, needs to be organized in such a way that other people can understand it and that other people can find. So I actually think the hardest part is not when you're starting and trying to figure out the institution and, you know, find other information, is when you're doing your own work. And you need to be able to recognize like what of your own work other people will need in the future. So I think for me, that was kind of the struggle. And I think probably everyone struggles with this, is that, you know, how detailed does a documentation need to be? What knowledge do you assume people have when they read the documentation for the first time? You know, even if it's internal, that's kind of, if anything, when it's internal, sometimes that's even harder to say, because you don't know who's going to pick up the job in the future, right? There's a certain amount that you could assume, but there's a certain amount that you're like, well, I don't know. Like, I have no idea who's going to be doing this in the future, that sort of thing. So definitely, yeah, for me, it's both a kind of a selfish thing, and that kind of turns into something that, you know, would help others in the future. But even the institution as like the organization as a whole, like you're going to save so much money by not having every single person who is looking for this information dig it up every time.
Mm. Yeah, for sure.
And I completely lost my train of thought.
And it's gone, fluttering by. Tom, I thought you might have had a question there.
It blanked my memory.
I can give you
a question if you... Oh, go ahead.
You go, Tom. Go, Tom.
Yeah, go, Tom.
I find it pretty fascinating that we have two librarians here, right? And it's interesting to see the points that you emphasize. It seems like there's a strong emphasis on knowledge management, on documenting processes so that others can find the information, how to organize it. Do you think that emphasis is partly due to your librarian background?
I do have a librarian background.
I think it's just true of people who recognize that need and see it. Actually, like I say, I've worked in a lot of libraries, and the fact that none of this was ever written down is like kind of just boggles my mind. That like, how do we have this many information professionals and none of this is written down anywhere?
Actually, so now I've remembered what my question was, and it follows on nicely. So Tom obviously was reading my mind, which was in how many cases when you've done this for the two of you, did people continue it afterwards, or did things? I mean, Amy already mentioned one where it did continue, but you know, when sometimes has a great idea and starts something, but then after you've left, it just stalls and it becomes kind of no use because it's out of date anyway. So yeah, how many kept doing it after you kind of kicked it off?
So far, I'm 3 for 3.
Okay.
That's
pretty good.
The library system that I worked at, and then the internal and external docs for my previous company still go with what I initially set up. The one that is a little bit of an outlier, and I wanted to circle back to Tom's question. It's actually related here. I'd actually broadened the scope from libraries to nonprofits. That every nonprofit that I've spent time with has a need for organization and infrastructure work, especially knowledge infrastructure work, because that never pays the bills and it's one of the last things to get funding and one of the first things to be cut. And so one of the questions that I saw working in the library, plus with there's a 501c3 that I do some volunteer work for, their first question is always, how much does this cost? And being able to provide some kind of solution that will let them have knowledge and process management without incurring costs that they frankly can't afford, because it all shows up as overhead and in the balance sheets at the end of the year.
Yep.
That I think is a better measure.
It's actually interesting you say this. I used to work in the not-for-profit sector as well. And I think we've all, most of us here on this call at the moment are in this sort of tech space. So we think around this space, but internal documentation is probably vastly more important and vastly underdone in many other sectors, actually.
Tom, you had something to say?
Yeah, no, I like the comparison to nonprofit because I feel like internal documentation is a nonprofit activity. People seem to really be interested in outward-facing documentation, right? But all this internal information about the different systems required and to set up the processes that are going to enable that external docs, nobody really seems to care about that until some new person onboards and they're completely lost, right? So I can see how this is a sort of a nonprofit endeavor. Do you separate out – oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Do you separate out in your internal documentation kind of like a runbook for your doc team versus a sort of internal customer-facing intake manual for how they work with your team? Like, how do you separate out the different components of internal docs?
I think that would be different depending on the organization. So what's interesting is that, like, a lot of nonprofits and like public institutions that I've worked at, there's, you know, there isn't really so much a separation between like thinking about something for like that you would use in dealing with customers. I mean, to a certain extent, there is like and what's interesting is that a lot of places I've worked at, that's actually often well documented, is how you either external documentation, which is outward facing for users, or, you know, internally and how to deal or work with users, because especially in a lot of public institutions, almost everyone is doing that. Those processes are actually often well documented, or, I mean, again, maybe not in the tool of your choice, but at least it is often written down because that's part of some kind of like guideline, or this is how you deal with this exact situation because it comes up all the time. What I find is often lacking are more things that are purely internal. So like again, it kind of boggles my brain that, like, some technology, a lot of technologies actually in public institutions, they're developed by a single person or maybe two, and then they say develop an internal tool that is used, but then don't document anything about how it's maintained, or may or may not even include inline comments for their code, and then they leave and then no one knows how to maintain it because there are no notes. There's, you know, you don't even know what language things are written in until you go look at the code itself. And that's assuming you, like, you know where to find the code. Like, it's just, it's actually quite interesting to see this happen, especially in public institutions, because, you know, users or customers, however you want to refer to them, like, are people that you often end up interacting with. And so I find those ones are the ones that are at least better documented, maybe not always fully documented, but better. And then, yeah, it's documenting these and a lot of the internal only things where, you know, like Amy says, a lot of people look at it and they're like, well, there's no money to be made from this. There's no, like they often don't see the future cost and the technical debt or the documentation debt that comes from not documenting it when it's happening.
Mm, yeah, that's pretty valid observation as well. Yeah, it's tooling is hard.
I can feel the pain points in what you're saying so prominently. Like last week, I spent 2 hours trying to figure out how permissions were orchestrated among like 5 different internal tools, and it was so confusing. It was like, okay, so this team is getting a permission from this thing, which is owned by that, and that gives me the account access, but it's not inherited. It was like, oh, such a jumble. Yeah, I spent all morning on that, and after that I was like, I'm done, I'm gonna go do something fun.
the worst part is where you're digging through all this. What clown set oh, it was me 3 years ago. I'm a jerk.
Yeah, sometimes code comments can be incriminating as well as informative, right?
Yep.
I usually have forgotten what I did 2 days ago as well. Actually, this is the wonderful thing of Git.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's right.
Although I seem to change my username way too much, so that also helps me forget and dodge responsibility. Did you manage to get anybody else on board in any of these examples to help out during, I mean, hopefully after, or had anyone tried before, I guess? Was there any collaboration in getting this this stuff documented?
In my case, I think what ended up happening in a lot of cases was that, you know, I would usually just go do it. And if a manager, you know, asked me what I was doing with my time, I was like making the place better. Sometimes I was a little vague about like, well, I'm working on the project. You know, like
project.
this project that you told me to work on. So like, I've told this story before, probably not at Write the Docs, but 3 of my contracts was migrating a Dreamweaver template HTML CSS website to WordPress. Lo and behold, that was that migration project was always an interesting one. I rarely documented the actual migration because I was just like, well, you only really need to do this once. No one is ever going to touch the Dreamweaver site again. We're going to deprecate that, and no one needs to go through this migration process again, thankfully. So, you know, often there are, like, it is sometimes recognizing, okay, what do you need to document for future use and what you don't, right? And so, you know, I wouldn't bother documenting something like the migration process, but how is the WordPress, you know, system set up? Like, how is the you have a new CMS, you know you're going to be using it for at least a few years. How's it set up? Who is managing it? All of that, right? And, you know, I would just say this is part of the project, right? Like, this needs to be written down for future use, or even for my colleagues, my own teammates to, you know, refer to. I would often just kind of justify it that way. And then I would probably say that in most cases, people didn't really always see the benefit of it until later, right? And often until after I left, right? Mm-hmm. Because they'd be like, oh, we should ask this person. Oh, wait, no, it's written down. We don't need to, like, I always say, like, if people do not need to email me after I've left a job, I've done my job, right? And I think that kind of comes back to this idea of, like, you know, the whole bus factor thing in tech, where, you know, if someone is hit by a bus, I mean, if you want to take the more positive spin, is the if someone wins the lottery and, you know, kind of runs off. And,
you know. I've not heard that version. I don't know which
the lottery factor. Let's make that a thing.
The lottery factor. But it is this idea where, like, if someone is suddenly for any reason gone, would someone be able to pick it up? Would people know what's going on with whatever they were maintaining? And so what's interesting is that often I think, especially in public institutions, they don't see the benefit until something comes up. So I, to this day, the only time I've actually had people email me after I kind of left the job was in one job where I was still on retainer. And so people felt it was easier to email me, and I would just reply to them with a wiki link. I wouldn't even write almost anything in the body. I'd be like, you can find it here.
You're basically Google for them. It's their search implementation. Yeah.
After a few of those emails, people learned.
They probably just thought you were a bot. Just responding to emails.
But yeah, I mean, I think that's it. It's that, you know, I was often able to justify it as this is just part of the project work, and definitely people saw in other cases, people saw the benefit, you know, before I left. You know, especially when I did things like when I was kind of more reorganizing the docs at one point, I mentioned like moving from some free wiki to the Confluence wiki. And as part of that move, I decided to actually make use of user experience skills and come out with a new information architecture using like a card sort, which is very common in kind of web development. And so I think it was a really interesting exercise, and people kind of saw like immediately from going through that exercise, kind of the benefits of taking time to reorganize how our documentation was put together, because it was so cobbled together. Every time someone needed something new, they just create a new page, and, you know, you'd have orphaned pages and all this other craziness, and, you know, things were not always organized, and because people would be like, oh, well, let's just make a whole new category. I'm like, why would you make a whole new category of what exists, you know, and that sort of thing. So in there are cases where people saw the benefit right away, but definitely it's not until you get to that point where either you know, where you would have the kind of technical debt kind of, or documentation debt point, I think that people either see, oh, we didn't have to go through that pain point of documentation debt, and therefore we see the benefit now, or documentation debt happened, and then they're like, oh, we should have done that, right?
Yeah, it gets to that tipping point, doesn't it? Hey, look, we are fast running out of time, but there are a few things I'd like to focus on too, because I think this is sort of like this question I'm going to ask now is about, I guess, your own mental state when you're actually doing this and keeping yourself in check. And that is, was there ever a point when you were doing this, the writing gig as part of your job, was there ever a point when you went, no, help, I need to put my hand up here and say, this is too much for me to actually manage at this point? Was there any, Cynthia, was there a point for you that you got to that point?
I was going to get Amy to speak first because I feel
Amy, like, actually, that's a good idea, Amy. let's hear what you have to say about that.
Um, the best example I could give would be after we migrated over to a DOCSIS code approach, which was a huge, huge, heavily contested deal at my previous company. One of the first things we were able to do once we had these things in flat files was to run some lovely shell commands over what we had and then go terrify some execs by saying, so let me tell you what our writers are responsible for. How do you feel about war and peace? Our word count was larger.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of words.
That got their attention.
So on a raw word count, that was a metric that you used to say, hey, so how about maybe one more or 100 more writers, please?
Please, how about you, sir?
Yeah, please, sir, may I have some more workers, please? How about you, Cynthia? Was it a little bit the same or was it different for you?
I think it was different because, you know, most of the time we didn't have a ton of external docs. And even if we did, there wasn't the same emphasis as like for a product where, you know, the docs need to be consistent across, you know, all the pages and that sort of thing. So a lot of our external docs were, you know, written by whoever was going to maintain them. And it didn't like it was usually separated by subject and all this other stuff. So it didn't have the same kind of emphasis externally. So internally, I mean, you know, it was one of those being practical things is you can only do so much as a single person, especially when documentation is not your full-time job and it's just off the side of your desk kind of thing, is that I would often be in the kind of position where I would help maintain the general structure and give guidance when people had questions. But in no way was I editing other people's work unless I specifically found, I would sometimes even typos I wouldn't even bother fixing as long as the meaning was still coming across and that sort of thing, right? So if it was written in different styles and that sort of thing, it just didn't even matter. The information was there. It was understandable. If I had questions, then I would kind of go to the person who wrote it and be like, hey, you know, I wasn't too clear on this point when I was reading through it and trying to follow the instructions. Could you clarify it? Or, you know, can you clarify for me? I'm happy to update it. And, you know, that's one of the nice things about having anything where everyone can kind of edit it, right? Is like, whether it's a wiki or even a Word doc, like, whatever it is.
People can chip in and help, right?
Yeah,
have a go.
And actually, interestingly...
I had a question burning in the back of my mind that just has come maybe appropriately. I'd like to ask a specific question about both of your roles now. And GitLab is somewhat infamous amongst some other companies for putting a lot of things public, including, I don't know how much is actually public, but onboarding, internal discussions, all these sorts of things. And I mean, it's a somewhat unique ish position, but has that ever caused problems having like so much internal onboarding documentation public to anybody?
I'm making a face. I'm waiting to see if Cynthia says the thing first.
I'm going to try to be diplomatic about this and just like, if you look at the press articles that have gone out, the answer is yes. If you really want to know, I mean, it's out there. You can specifically, the Register has reported on a number of controversial either discussions or incidents that have happened. I'm not going to comment further on that part of it.
I wasn't aware of this. Wasn't a loaded question. I wasn't even aware of it.
It is a bit of a loaded question, even if you. I won't comment further on the kind of more controversial topics. I will say, personally, being on the support team, we have actually had people just come in and even it's like we have the kind of team trackers, like projects where we, you know, we discuss workflows and stuff, you know, internal to the team. Docs has it, you know, support, UX, every team has these sorts of trackers where you can write an issue because, you know, you work globally, you're not always going to be in a sync call together to discuss things. So that's why we often discuss things async in writing. And we've had just people who are not part of the organization come in and comment on things. And positive, sometimes they're not, I mean, they're not, they may not always be constructive. And sometimes we'll just respond and say, hey, you know, like,
well, what?
Like, who are you?
I don't know that you have the context, like further context of how our team works to really be able to, you know, comment on this. Other times we have actually had like customers comment on, you know, what support is doing, because obviously what support does have has a huge effect on them. So other times, you know, definitely we've made issues confidential if we're like, okay, this is, especially if it's a security matter or it's related to security or legal, all a lot of those are actually confidential from the get-go. So, you know, there are times when it's just someone makes the decision to make something confidential. But I will say, yeah, it's definitely interesting because especially in support, we've actually had users link back to our own workflow and handbook pages to almost be like, hey, you say this on your website, even though it's like not officially the website, it's our handbook, internal process stuff. And they're like trying to rationalize why they're asking for something by linking to our own guidebook. And, you know, I think that's fine. I mean, the information is out there.
It's out there. Exactly. Yeah. Look, I've got one final question before we wrap up the show. And that is, and I'll ask this of both Cynthia and Amy, so I'll start with Amy first. If you had to do the whole process of starting up a, like getting into documentation when it's not your job, what would the one thing be that you'd change about doing it all?
I would have started with a docs as code approach a lot earlier than I did. The amount of covering fire, the ability to just run git blame on documentation. It sounds silly until the first time you get a call from your legal team saying, can you please tell us who told you to say XYZ? Because we now have a contractual problem about this.
Oh, dear.
Oh, yeah.
That's a very good insight. Yeah. Docs as code, or it didn't happen.
Be able to prove if you're going to allow anyone to say anything or mostly anything in your docs, be able to prove who said it.
Really good advice, Amy. Very good. Cynthia, what do you think, pardon me, the one thing you would change about going doing all this again?
I would say that I would probably try to get management buy-in a little earlier in some of the situations I've been in, just because, like, there are times when it gets to the point where, you know, a supervisor or manager might say, why are you spending all this time on doing this? So I think, you know, there are at least a, you know, at least one place I worked at where I definitely probably would have gone to my manager or supervisor a little earlier. And definitely if you're trying to get, you know, anything team-wide or, you know, organization-wide, doing this is definitely, you need management on board to kind of push that out further. So again, like, you want to get it team-wide, go to whoever manages the team early, try to get their buy-in, you know, just be like realistic and be like, hey, you know, we need to write this down because if something ever happens, you know, we need to know what's going on. And then I think you can kind of just build out from there to get it to, you infect more and more teams and eventually you'll get the whole organization. but I definitely would say that. Versioning, I think, is definitely important. I, again, often dealt with whatever tools were available. As long as you could look up, you had any kind of versioning system where you could look up who did certain edits, I think for us that was kind of the bare minimum. It's definitely a lot easier with something like Gitblame, where you're doing Doxus code, but I think anything where you have versioning is kind of a minimum baseline.
That's right. You get that for free in some programs, and some it's a little bit less than free. But yeah, I think it sounds like traceability and accountability is really important when you're sharing the load with documentation in general, because you have to know who's written what. And it's sometimes an innocent change to the docs that's worked out to be a contractual problem, but you know, you still need to find out, right? Yeah, those are really good insights for people who are just starting out on that. So thanks for sharing that. And that, regrettably, brings us to the end of the show. That has been a very fast hour. So I'd just like to thank Cynthia and Amy for coming on the show and sharing their insights with us, because it's been really, really interesting to sort of hear how you might go about setting up and putting technical writing into your job, and perhaps even starting a career in technical writing from something that's not your core responsibility. We need more documentarians in this world. So if that's a way you can do it, then come along and take that first step to actually writing the docs and making a difference for your company with their information management. So yeah, thank you very much, Cynthia and Amy, for coming along. And of course, thank you to our regular panelists, Chris and Tom, for their insights as well in today's show. So I'd just like to round out the show by saying that you can find past episodes of the show on podcast.writethedocs.org. You can also come and chat to us in the Write the Docs Slack as well. And we love to hear from folks who are listening to the podcast and perhaps have got inspiration about a subject that they'd like to talk about on the show. Because after all, Write the Docs podcast is about, and we do this for the Write the Docs community, to give folks a voice and to have them come on the show and share their knowledge, which everyone has a different knowledge that they can share. So it's really valuable to pitch us an idea. And chances are, just like Cynthia did, you'll be on the show talking about it. So, yeah, it's come on and give us some ideas. We're always looking for ideas for the show. So, yeah, come and check out the website. Hit us on Slack. And as you always, you have to remember that without you got to write the docs, and it's docs or it didn't happen. Thanks, everybody.